For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week we're reflecting on the regenerative power of nature. Sally Vickers discusses her new novel, The Gardener, and how it grew out of a long affinity with trees and gardens. Environmentalist Mark Lynas gives us our final warning about climate change and outlines the bitter harvest that we'll reap if we ignore it. Ellie Marsh goes digging in the RNIB library to bring us a crop of titles that focus on the environment. And Robert Kirkwood hears about some of the highs and lows of leading a more sustainable life from drummer turned farmer Chris Stewart. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Sally Vickers is the best-selling author of The Librarian and The Cleaner of Chartres. Her latest novel, The Gardener, is her 13th and has been described as an enchanting tale of the restoration of a garden and a soul. As I discovered, the seed for it was sown in her mind long ago and was nurtured by lockdown. Sally, welcome to Read On.
Hello, good to talk to you.
For those who haven't yet downloaded The Gardener from the RNIB Talking Books library, could you give us a brief synopsis?
It's about a pair of sisters who move to a dilapidated Jacobean house on the Welsh Marches, which is the border between England and Wales, the English side, and they're very different. The principal protagonist in the novel who narrates it is called Hassie. She has had a failed love affair and she's gone to nurse their father in his last years of sickness. And the father has died and left them both the sisters money. And slightly reluctantly, she's agreed to buy this house with her very much more successful sister, Margot, who still maintains a job in high finance in London. Hassie is an illustrator, once a rather successful one, a particular illustrator of a highly thought of children's novelist who's died. And her only work now is drawing for a series of books which she finds personally very obnoxious about a rather ersatz elf called Elphine. So there she is in this rambling Jacobean house, faced with a large and very neglected but potentially beautiful garden. And to help her in the garden, she hires an Albanian migrant who is himself a bit of a loner and has also had a failed marriage. So there's a kind of camaraderie between the two. And the novel really explores how working in the garden and walking through the nearby woods, which are very ancient, she begins to recover and ruminate about her past. It starts to fall into perspective and she becomes fascinated by the history of the area, which is a very fascinating area, which I know very well, and has a number of ancient Christian sites, particularly holy wells and the site of what were formerly sacred groves. And she discovers, as I did, that these sacred wells and sacred woods were actually pre-Christian and were part of what's called the old religion, which was the pagan worship, which was established in Britain before Britain was Christianized. And she also uncovers the history of the previous owner of the house, who, like her, has discovered aspects of the garden and the stream that runs at the bottom of the garden into this wood that are somewhat mysterious. So it's a novel really about the way in which nature is a healing power and a recuperative power. And I was going to write it anyway before lockdown, but the effect of lockdown was actually rather interesting because I had rented a rather modest little cottage in Wiltshire, but it happened to have a large neglected garden. And I found that as I was writing the book, I was also working in this big neglected garden and writing a book about a neglected garden, and also having the opportunity to go for walks in what is also a rather ancient countryside, fed into the book. And the consequence was I actually was one of those people who had rather a good lockdown because it allowed my book to evolve and develop in a very quiet but easy way. I found writing the book extremely therapeutic myself, and the people who've read it so far have said very kindly that it is a very healing sort of book. I mean, that sounds a bit New Agey. It's also a literary book, but it is about the healing power of nature and about, I suppose I would say, ancient forces that exist in the geological bones and history of Great Britain that people do encounter when they allow themselves to become exposed to them.
As you say, there's an awful lot to unpack in this book. But I think the thing that really struck me that you've already hinted at is just how ancient and timeless nature is in comparison with our own day-to-day worries and woes. And it helps provide perspective, especially for Hassie in the book, for her to be able to walk into something that shows regeneration every year, no matter how bad the winter has been, no matter how bad the frost has been, the garden will always regenerate.
That's absolutely what I felt. I'm so pleased that was your response. I mean, a lot of people are very struck by the relationship between the sisters, which is quite interesting because they are very different and they've had a mother who has done something which mothers can do. She's favoured the elder daughter, which has led to a kind of simmering resentment in Hassie, the younger daughter. But we learn as the book goes on that it's not been as easy for the elder sister, Margot, as Hassie herself believes. A lot of people have found that the most interesting part of the book. Like you, for me, what was most interesting was allowing my... I used to live on the Welsh marches, so I know it very well. For me, what was so interesting was allowing my own interest and... I don't like the word research because actually I never actually research. I only write about things I've already absorbed and I'm already interested in. But the way in which particularly these holy wells, which the Christians took over, and so the holy wells are attributed to saints who perform miracles. But actually what she discovers and I discovered is that they're much older than that. And whatever miracles are occurring through encounter with these springs and wells and these ancient woods is, as you suggest, Red, something to do with the very ancient but perpetually restoring power of nature and how little we are in comparison. So, as you quite rightly say, it puts things in perspective. And I think that is something that a lot of people, and I was certainly one of them, felt during lockdown, that somehow we've did something to the natural world, which we're paying the price for. And a return to the natural world is probably the best remedy we could find, both individually and, I would say, collectively. It wasn't written for that reason, but that reason got into the writing as I wrote it.
And it's something you also explore with the way the early Christians co-opted these ancient groves and wells. And they actually cut down the groves of trees because they were worried about people worshipping idols, I suppose, for want of a better word. And I know it's something that you've explored before in your book, Cousins, but you clearly wanted to go back further in time to those pre-Christian days and contact that natural growth that was cut off in the 5th century.
That's absolutely right. Gosh, that's wonderful that you've picked that out. That's the most perceptive observation I've had from anybody so far. Thank you. Yes, in Cousins, I do explore St. Cuthbert, who was a rather interesting 7th, 8th century saint. And in this book, St. Milburga, who had a priory in Much Wenlock. There's very little remains of that, but there were later Cluniac priories that were built on the same site. And in the book, Hassie visits Much Wenlock, because she's become interested in these early saints. And she finds when she gets there that she doesn't feel anything at all mystical or religious, which puzzles her. She's not a particularly religious person or hasn't been, but she is quite susceptible to influences of a certain kind. She feels this isn't really right. And what she learns is that the early Christians, well, there were two kinds of Christians. There was Celtic Christianity, which was actually much more involved with nature, and then there was Roman Christianity, which was urban, and it was really the urban Roman church which took over from the Celtic church, which instigated the cutting down of the sacred trees and the sacred groves, which was really an act of vandalism. But they did allow the taking over of these holy wells. But you're quite right. I often explore what people call religious or spiritual themes, but it's not confined to Christianity by any means. It's really more people's instinct for a metaphysical dimension in life. And in this book, I think, pushed by my initial exploration of the Celtic Christians, I wanted to move back in time. It's rather unclear what actually was worshipped, but it does appear to be nature, trees and springs and pools. And the wood that she walks through, which has a pool, she's called Halcyon. Her surname is Days, and her father's a bird watcher, and he calls her Halcyon because it's a sort of joke. Halcyon Days means a period of peace and calm. And in Greek mythology, the Halcyon bird is thought to be a kingfisher. So the kingfisher's her special bird, and as she finds the stream at the bottom of the garden, she sees the kingfisher, and as she walks through the woods, there's a pool where she stops and she reflects. And she, at one particular moment in the book, she sees the kingfisher, and she kind of takes that as a sign of something. It's what Jung referred to as synchronicity. It's when you see something in the external world which matches something in your internal world and gives it significance. And I have Hassie have that experience in this wood, which we learn is one of those ancient groves that didn't get cut down and where things happen. I won't say what. I leave it quite ambiguous because I like ambiguity.
And the fact that she and Murat, the Albanian migrant refugee, both dispossessed people, are able to reconnect with their lives through these ancient places is absolutely core to the book.
Well, you don't really know about Murat. I wanted him to be a person upon whom people project their own unconscious characteristics. So, of course, he becomes a focus for hostility in the village. But for Hassie, he becomes something else. Initially, she has a rather conventional, if benign, reaction to him. But as the book goes on, she more and more feels a kind of connection with him, which you don't know how far he responds to it, except just in tiny ways he starts to. He arrives one day and makes her a cup of Greek coffee, which he's been missing. And, of course, he becomes extremely enthusiastic about the garden, having known nothing about it. He also plays backgammon with Miss Foote, who is a character who, I must say, I did like writing, because she's a retired schoolteacher, very sharp, very bright, been in the village and taught the village children for many, many years. But she's also a bit a fish out of water, because she's highly intellectual, and there isn't much intellectual company in the village. So she becomes very close to Hassie, and there's a sort of triangle between Miss Foote, Murat, and Hassie, which, well, I like triangles. I write a lot about instances of the number three, where three roads meet. I think the young woman and the older woman and the young man form quite an interesting chemistry, which produces something quite interesting at the end.
I'm so glad you mentioned Miss Foote, because you narrate the book yourself, and she's a wonderful character, and I could really hear the relish with which you read her lines. This is obviously a very personal book. Was it important for you that you should narrate the book yourself?
It was very important. In the past, my agent has sold the audio rights to people outside Penguin. Penguin have always wanted me to narrate the books, and I particularly wanted to narrate Grandmothers, actually, which was my previous book. I don't terribly like the way my books get narrated because, I mean, no disrespect to the actors, but I like an underplayed tone most of the time. I don't like overemphasis. But I think another thing is that people often miss the sort of slight irony that I give to certain characters. And I was particularly keen to read this one. And so Penguin were actually delighted when I offered. And actually, I did enjoy doing it. But you're right. There's usually a character in all my books to whom I give not all my opinions, but a version of them. It's something I've started doing with Miss Garnett's Angel with the Monseigneur. And while I don't want to take characters from life and write about them, I do occasionally want to express something of my own worldview, and it's something one can do through certain kinds of characters. So I take different people to express my point of view. And Miss Foote has quite a few of my points of view. Not all. I mean, I don't think I'm especially like her, but I think quite a few of her views, you could say Sally Vickers would agree with, particularly her comments about religion, I think. I allowed a little self-indulgence there. I don't think I'm as sharp as Miss Foote, but I do share a number of her opinions, yes. So I'm glad you liked her.
I was surveying the moss-bound humps and ragged stretches of knee-high grass in the garden's rolling lawn with a mixture of awe and resentment. Rampant weeds had invaded those parts of the flowerbeds that were visible behind the hunched mass of brambles. Vicious-looking nettles awaited, darkly baleful. Towards the further end of the garden I could make out ivy-engulfed trees, braceleted with evil yellow fungi, which put me in mind of Arthur Rackham. Aged 6, I had a most disturbing nightmare after stealing a book of fairy tales from my sister Margot. A handsome, hardback book, which I'd coveted like mad, bound in red cloth with indented gold lettering, and a picture on the cover of a weird tree man with branches issuing wildly from his head and hands. It was an illustration of a witch for a story called The Two Sisters, which is perhaps relevant, that prompted the nightmare. I have hated Rackham ever since.
Sally Vickers narrating her novel, The Gardener.
Sally, I know that literacy has been at the core of your whole life, so you must be absolutely delighted that so many of your books are audiobooks and therefore available to people with print disabilities.
Well, actually, I write for the ear, so for me, they are tremendously important. I mean, luckily, I can read, but when I read, I hear the words, and when I'm writing, I hear the words, and the rhythm of a sentence, the cadence, and the sound of the words is actually very, very important to me. And one of the reasons I wanted to read my own book is, you know, I sometimes find actors who haven't had much chance to read the book, poor things, get the rhythms wrong. They don't hear the rhythms. And as you know, the spoken voice is the very first thing we as human beings in the womb respond to. And actually, when I worked as a psychotherapist, I could tell a great deal from the timbre of somebody's voice. If somebody rang me and left a message on the answer phone and I didn't know them, I already knew a lot about them just from the quality of their voice. You know, you can hear tension, you can hear anxiety, you can hear anger. It's an incredibly sensitive medium. And for people who cannot read the printed word, I imagine the quality of the sound is so much more important.
And of course, storytelling is an oral tradition.
Absolutely an oral tradition. That's something I'm always saying. It's rather sad in a way that so many people rely on print. I mean, that's an odd thing for me to say, perhaps. But being read to is so important. And you know, when I was at school, we had a story read to us at the end of every day in my primary school. I don't think that happens now. It hasn't, as far as I know, happened to my grandchildren, which, I mean, they are read stories at home, luckily, and I've read them a lot of stories. But I learned to read on Beatrix Potter because my parents read me Beatrix Potter, and she writes wonderfully. She's got the most wonderful cadence, wonderful rhythm. She's also got a superbly rich vocabulary. So I learned an enormous number of words just from hearing them. But I think being read to aloud is terribly important. And I think it's a bit of a shame that it stops for most people with childhood. This is why audiobooks are so important. And I will always in future try and read an audiobook, unless it's a very male-oriented book, in which case I would get a sensitive actor if I could.
And I believe that the seeds of The Gardener were sown a very long time ago in your childhood when you first came to London and found sanctuary in a walled garden.
Yes. My father was a very active communist and he lost his job as the warden of an adult education college for trade unionists. And we came to London and we lived in my godmother's house. But it did have the most wonderful garden because my godmother and her husband had no children. And the garden was, as it were, their nursery. And my mother and father, and then when he came along, my little brother, lived in the upper part of the house. But I had a room downstairs and it looked out onto the garden. And I, first of all, became their helper in the garden. But also there was a wild white cherry tree just outside my window. And there was a wall, and I used to climb out of my window, sit on the wall, and I had a kind of... This happens a lot with children, actually. I think we forget it as we grow, but I have never forgotten it. I had this mystical relationship with the cherry tree. I can't really put it any other way. I didn't think of it like that then, of course, but I felt the cherry tree and I were in some kind of communion. And one of the first traumas of my life was when, in a hurricane, when I would have been six, I remember my mother took me under the table. My mother was bombed in the war and lost both her legs, so thunderstorms always frightened her. And this was a big one, and it blew the cherry tree down. And I remember that as one of the first real traumas of my life. It wasn't the loss of a person, it was the loss of a tree. But the garden was terribly important, and I am named Sally with an E from a poem by W.B. Yeats. My father was a great lover of poetry and he loved Yeats. My mother loved the song, which is set to music by Benjamin Britten. So that's why I have the name Sally with an E. And it actually means willow in Irish. Somehow, really from the moment I was named, I suppose gardens, they're in my unconscious as well as my conscious.
And clearly that connection with trees has grown fully to maturity in The Gardener. Sally Vickers, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of the book. And I certainly hope that you'll undertake narrating more audiobooks in years to come.
I would love to do that, Red. It's such a pleasure to me to read, as it's a pleasure to listen to good readings.
The Gardener joins a wide selection of Sally Vickers' other novels in the RNIB library, thanks to the generosity of publisher Penguin Random House. And Sally will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this show, Ellie Marsh brings us a crop of books about the environment from the RNIB Library. And we explore the joys and challenges of smallhold farming with a former member of Genesis. But first, last year in the build-up to COP26, I interviewed leading environmental writer Mark Lynas, whose latest book, Our Final Warning, 6 degrees of Climate Emergency, considers the consequences of global warming and what each increment means to the survival of life on Earth. Mark, welcome to Read On.
Thank you, Red. It's great to be with you.
Now, this really is our final warning, isn't it?
Yes, unfortunately it is. And I titled the book that because I wrote an earlier completely different version of this idea, if you like, the 6 degrees idea, looking at the future impacts of climate change back in 2007. And so I wanted to say really that we're now at a situation which, I mean, how to put it other than it is our final warning, we don't have any more time to go on putting off cuts to climate changing greenhouse gas emissions if we want to avoid some of the really more catastrophic end of impacts that I detail in the book.
In the book, you break it down degree by degree as to, well, the canaries in the mine that will die if we don't stop heating the world's atmosphere. What happens if we only increase by 1 degree?
Well, we're already in the 1 degree world. So that chapter is describing the impacts that we're already seeing, such as the mass disappearance of the world's corals. And also the melt of Greenland and Antarctica has really defied all expectations and happened more rapidly than certainly I was expecting 10, 15 years ago. At one point last year in 2019, Greenland was losing something like 600 billion tons of ice, which was enough to raise global sea levels by 2 millimeters in just 2 months. We've seen also the very rapid disappearance of the Arctic sea ice. In fact, in the UK at the moment, we're having this very strange seesaw between an incredibly wet period in the late winter, and February was really wet. And now we've suddenly got the sunniest and probably the driest spring ever. And so you're actually seeing weather patterns stuck in these configurations, which may well trace back to the disappearing Arctic sea ice. So these are some of the things that we're seeing, and I actually quantify in the book what the amount of extra heat is that's now being captured in the Earth system due to this increasing amount of greenhouse gases which we've got accumulated in the atmosphere. And it adds up to 6 zettajoules per year, which is 6 to the power of 21, and it's the same heat as 3 Hiroshima atomic bombs exploding in the oceans every single second.
Goodness. And at 2 degrees?
Well, at 2 degrees we'll sadly see the loss of about 99% of the world's coral reef, so that it'll be a biome which more or less ceases to exist across the planet, and the first of many, unfortunately. We'll see tens of millions of more people exposed to exceptional lethal heat waves. We'd also begin to see impacts on the world's food supplies, which is something I'm very concerned about, given that we're projected to see population growing to 9 or 10 billion by 2050, if we see a net reduction in the amount of food which is available, that would reduce the amount of calories available per person. And the projections at the moment are about another 500,000 additional deaths from malnutrition by mid-century. And there's also, in terms of the Earth system, the risk of tipping points. So we'd lose about 40% of the permafrost, that frozen ground in the Arctic, which when it melts, releases methane and carbon dioxide in the hundreds of billions of tons potentially. So even if we arrest the warming at 2 degrees, all of that extra carbon coming from the Arctic permafrost could then take us over that level and continue the warming further than you'd want. So that's always the danger, really, is that if we continue emitting fossil fuels and allowing the warming to accelerate, then that probably triggers tipping points in the Earth system, which then, while not necessarily making it unstoppable, add more warming into the system in decades to come.
Your book is incredibly well researched. It has rather been your life's work over the last 15 or so years. Do you see a coming together of scientific and political will on climate change, or are the two still separated by the need for votes and economic success?
Before the pandemic, I felt there was a real sense of momentum. You had the school strikers movement, Extinction Rebellion in the UK and elsewhere. And so the protester end of things was really beginning to capture the mainstream. And in the UK, we've got now a net zero target, which was unthinkable 10 years ago when I was writing the first iteration of this book. So I think it's okay to be encouraged by that. But we've got to make sure that we meet these targets and hopefully even exceed them, because at the current time, the pledges that the world's governments have put forward to meet the 2015 Paris Agreement don't meet the targets of the Paris Agreement, which was 1.5 to 2 degrees. In fact, if you add all of the government pledges together, it takes us still all the way up to 3 degrees, which is pretty unimaginable in terms of the scale of the impacts that we'd then experience. So there's just a huge amount more to do, and we need to not lose the momentum that was there before the pandemic. And in fact, we need to take the lessons that we've learned from dealing with a global crisis in the very short term and somehow leverage these lessons into dealing with the climate crisis, which is more obviously of a medium and a long-term challenge.
So if we imagine ourselves in 10 years' time, where do you think we'll be?
Well, I'm not a futurist. And while this book is a scientific project, it's also a piece of advocacy. So I want to change the kind of world that we see by writing a book like this. And one would hope that issuing a final warning of 6 degrees would help, to whatever small extent, push forward that momentum that we, I think, are seeing in terms of how climate change is dealt with. It's very difficult to make predictions about what kind of world we're going into, even in the very short term, of course, because we don't know how rapidly we're going to be able to exit from the pandemic. We don't know what the economic situation is going to be, whether it's going to be one of panic and collapse or a much more managed recovery. If it's the latter, then we have a higher chance, I think, of pushing with recovery funds into a much more sustainable future, because there'll be a need for a lot of investment and job creation, and that can go into things which decarbonize the economy. The thing is, you can probably tell from my tone, I'm a fairly irrevocable optimist. I don't know why. I mean, there's plenty of stuff to be pessimistic about, but there's also things that we've successfully achieved in the past. We don't have a population of, what is it, more than 7 billion by accident. It's because we've been incredibly successful as a species in harnessing the planet to meet our needs with food production and modern healthcare and those kinds of things. So it's incredible what humanity can achieve when we as a species put our minds to something. And I don't see any reason why we shouldn't have equal success with at least limiting the more dramatic impacts of climate change and not destroying the one planet that we have and call home.
Well, I think that's a good optimistic note to end the interview on. Mark Linus, thank you for leading us through our final warning, and let's hope that your optimism is borne out when I come to interview you about the sequel in a few years' time.
I will return with great joy, and we'll look back together on how successfully we dealt with this crisis. Yes, let's end on that note.
Our final warning, 6 degrees of climate emergency, is available from the RNIB library. And it's far from the only book there that focuses on environmental matters, as Read On reporter Ellie Marsh discovered.
If you're feeling inspired by the COP26 Climate Summit and are wanting to get a little bit more clued up on all things environment, then the RNIB's Talking Books Library is just the place for you. We've collected together some of the best books that you can access for free on the RNIB Talking Books website. And we're kicking off with net zero, a term that's thrown around a lot these days, but what does it actually mean? Net Zero, a book by Professor Dieter Helm, is his view on how we can stop causing climate change by adopting a net zero strategy of reducing carbon emissions and increasing carbon absorption. In this book, we look at why the past 30 years of efforts have failed, and why and how the next 30 years can succeed.
30 years ago, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher gave a speech to the UN which summarised the science as it was then understood and highlighted the need for global action to address the great new climate change problem. This speech is about as green as it gets for a politician, although a great deal of subsequent research has refined that science and our understanding of the immense and subtle complexity of our climate. The main planks of the analysis were already in place back then, and they have remained remarkably robust ever since.
Net Zero, How We Stop Causing Climate Change by Dieter Helm is available in full on the RNIB Talking Books Library. Next up in this one-stop guide, Bianca Negredi analyses the science of climate change and offers a concise overview of the ways in which our carbon emissions might be reduced. She looks at initiatives to create green industry and transport and explains the economics of emissions trading schemes and the practicalities of geoengineering plans to trap greenhouse gases, as well as addressing the fundamental question, is it possible to safeguard our future before it's too late?
The year 2020 will go down in history for a number of reasons. Wildfires and a global pandemic being pretty close to the top of the list. It also marked the first year on record that the global fleet of coal-fired power stations got smaller rather than larger. Some of that decline can be attributed to the global slowdown caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, but most of it is the result of the accelerating uptake of renewable energy. While renewable energy contributed 26% of global electricity generation at the end of 2019, by the end of the first quarter of 2020, it was already up to 27.5%. As significant as this increase is, it's not nearly enough.
Climate Change, How We Can Get to Carbon Zero by Bianca Negredi is available to listen to in full on the RNIB's Talking Books library. Now, if you're thinking, well, what about me? What can I do? It can all be a little bit overwhelming. Well, Jane Fonda might have the answer. In her book, What Can We Do? The Truth About Climate Change and How to Fix It, Jane Fonda, one of the most inspiring activists of our time, urges us to wake up from the looming disaster of climate change and equips us with the tools we need to join her protest.
It was a beautiful day. On the morning of October 11, 2019, we all gathered in the United Methodist Building near the Capitol for a pre-rally briefing. I wore the red coat I had bought on sale a few days before at Neiman's, and a black and white checked cap to hide the 2 inches of gray hair I was letting grow in. Hair epiphanies have always accompanied my life transformations, and going gray felt right for my new and maybe final turning point. Little did I know that the red coat would become a popular Halloween costume a few weeks later, and a pop culture totem. I was scared, and I hadn't slept. You know, it's that fear. What if I give a party and no one comes? I mean, we thought it would work, but none of us were certain if this weekly action would actually gain traction and make a difference. The core team was all there, plus two of the speakers and about a dozen activists who wanted to engage in civil disobedience with me and risk arrest, like Karen Nussbaum, Annie Leonard, and Steve Kretzman, director of Oil Change International.
You can listen to the full audiobook recording of What Can I Do? The Truth About Climate Change and How to Fix It by Jane Fonda on the RNIB Talking Books Library. Next, a name we all know, Bill Gates, who with help from experts in the fields of physics, chemistry, biology, engineering, political science, and finance, in his book Climate Disaster, has focused on what must be done in order to stop the planet's slide towards certain environmental disaster. As Bill Gates makes clear, achieving zero emissions will not be simple or easy to do, but if we follow the plan that he sets out here, it is a goal firmly within our reach.
There are two numbers you need to know about climate change. The first is 51 billion. The other is zero. 51 billion is how many tons of greenhouse gases the world typically adds to the atmosphere every year. 51 billion tons is based on the latest available data. Global emissions dropped a bit in 2020, probably around 5%, because the COVID-19 pandemic slowed the economy so dramatically. But because we don't know the exact figure for 2020, I will use 51 billion tons as the total.
How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, The Solutions We Have and the Breakthroughs We Need by Bill Gates can be found in full on the RNIB Talking Books Library. Now, if you're feeling like this is a little bit too much and you need a little bit of hope, then check out Tim Flannery's Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions for the Climate Crisis. Professor Tim Flannery introduces us to the innovative new solutions being developed around the world, which work with the Earth's systems to combat climate change and could safeguard our future. The tools required to avoid climate disaster already exist. Between emissions cuts and emerging technology, we can do it.
As I researched this book, I came across the most astonishing solutions to our climate problem. None is a silver bullet, but may have the potential to make big contributions. Their diversity in nature and in the regions they are taking place in is heartening. Even in poor nations, people are working on effective and innovative solutions. It does seem now that much of the world is finally beginning to act. Our inconsistent political approach has also yielded some surprising results. From Germany to the US and Japan, the developed countries that acted under the Kyoto Protocol, or in other ways, have created strong economic growth while sharply reducing emissions. Breaking the link between prosperity and pollution, and creating new links between wealth and clean power, are the best signs yet that we might keep ourselves safe.
You can find the full audiobook recording of Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis by Tim Flannery on the RNIB Talking Books Library.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB Helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Sally Vickers to share the books of her life, in the future, we'll all need to be more self-sufficient and sustainable. One man who took this to heart many years ago is one of the founding members of the band Genesis, who, incidentally, were originally called The Garden Wall. But former drummer Chris Stewart, who upped sticks and moved to a very rural part of Spain, soon discovered that his Garden of Eden needed a lot of work. He began to write about his new life as a farmer, and the first volume of his memoir, Driving Over Lemons, is a particular favourite of Robert Kirkwood's. Chris joined Robert from his home in Spain, and they began with a sound check. Over to you, Robert.
Chris Stewart, join me via satellite phone from the terrace of El Valero. And as usual, as you're checking your levels, you ask the person what they had for breakfast.
Right, presumably for levels.
Yes.
I have what I have for breakfast every single morning of the year, which is toast and olive oil and tomato and garlic and salt and pepper, and then another piece of toast with some marmalade on it.
All from the garden?
All from the garden. It sets you up for the day.
Now, you're on the terrace of El Valero, the hero farm of the book. So can you tell us what you see? Describe the view you have right now.
What could I see? Well, I'm sitting out on the terrace, as I say, so you can hear the bird song, but there aren't any birds. They've suddenly stopped. They're nervous, I think. So all I can see from here is mountains and rivers and pine trees and the trees on the terrace. And that's when we live really quite a long way out. And so you've got this patch of land here where you cannot see another house from, nor another light at night. And that's one of the great pleasures. So we get the stars and the moon in a way that's really, you know, quite rare these days in Europe. There's not that much land as wild as this and as isolated. And we love that. And here it is. And it's green, all around the house. It's green, although we've had the driest winter we've had in years. But it's a green oasis here because we happen to have good spring water here.
That happened in the book, actually, the river going past the farm run dry. Has that happened again?
Well, it happens periodically. And southern Spain is a land of droughts over and over again. So I reckon the main river will dry up this year and live about the third time in 25 years. But it always feels like a sort of cataclysm, you know, because you just rely. So I don't know if you can hear, you can possibly hear a sort of faint susurration in the background. That is the river. But, you know, you get so used to it and it means so much to you. Because funnily enough, yesterday I was up in the mountains at the source of our river, right at the head of it. And it waters so much for you when you live in a hot, dry climate like this that's prone to frequent droughts.
Now, I know there was a chapter in Parrot in the Pepper Tree about telephony. But I'm aware many listeners are only up to the end of Driving Over Lemons just now. So other than the satellite phone we're talking on, what's new at El Valero technology-wise?
Ah, right. OK, well, quite a lot. No, we have faster broadband internet access than friends in London do, believe it or not. And that took time because the first 6 years here we were without a telephone. I remember now that was one of the episodes when we installed the telephone. All that stuff's true, folks. I'm not capable of making stories up, unfortunately, which is what I'd really like to be able to do. But all I can do is write down what really happens. So what else have we got? We've got that. Driving Over Lemons sold quite a few copies, so we found ourselves a little bit more comfortably off than we were before. And we were able to install some new solar panels. And so now, although all our power comes from solar electricity, we've got a freezer and a fridge, which we're terribly proud of. And the fridge is one of those fridges, when you open the door, an electric light comes on, would you believe? after 23 years of a gas fridge, which didn't have a light inside it, we were used to it. And it was like a miracle for us to have a fridge that a light came on inside it.
And through all those books, you do return a lot to your profession of sheep shearing. Do you think that when you first moved into the area, that you brought a new farming technology helped your acceptance somewhat?
Oh, without doubt. And first of all, we came here quite early on in that there were not very many other foreigners living here when we arrived. I mean, there were some. We were not the first by any means. But there were very few, and so we were considered to be rather strange in those days. But then But we were farmers. We'd been farmers in England. We'd had our own flock of sheep, and I'd made a living as a sheep shearer. And therefore, we were interested in all the same things that our neighbours were, and they sort of knew what made us tick, and they could understand what we were about. And also, we spoke a bit of Spanish when we arrived as well. So we were accepted really very warmly and straight away, and we've never, ever had any trouble with that. And then later on, the sheep shearing episode, when I started shearing sheep around here, then I really felt I was part of the area then, and I sort of, you know, became known. And yeah, it was a nice feeling to be involved in that closer way in the place where you live.
In your second book, you do talk about your time in the band Genesis. I wasn't going to mention this, but there was a recent reunion documentary on TV. Why weren't you in it?
Well, they didn't ask me. I think, I'm sure you know the story. I mean, they very sensibly threw me out, asked me to leave, so it says on the Wikipedia page. Which is probably the wisest move they ever made. And I guess I must have been pretty upset at the time, but I don't remember that, because one doesn't remember things like that. And I bear them no ill will. No, I wasn't a part of it. I was, you know, this is a long time ago. We're talking about when I was 15, 16 years old, and I was a kid, a schoolboy drummer, and a crap drummer at that. So I think, you know, they really wanted to erase all memory of that from their minds.
Have any of them visited you on the farm?
Yes. Tony Banks came to lunch once. You know, I bump into them from time to time, but our paths very pretty rarely cross, as you can imagine. It's a rather different lifestyle. Not that it bothers us, really, because we sort of like to be cut off. It's a great pleasure to it. You know, we're not going to starve to death. We've got plenty of food in the larder, and we really feel the rest of the world is cut off from us rather than us from the rest of the world, and we like it that way. It's nice. It's peaceful. And all those things that you feel you ought to do but you haven't got round to doing, well, it doesn't matter. You can't do them because you're stuck here and there's nowhere you can go, and it's great.
How do you see yourself? Would you describe yourself as a writer or a farmer?
Well, it depends who I'm with, really. I mean, if I'm with farmers, I describe myself as a writer, and if I'm with writers, I describe myself as a farmer. But I've written 5 books now, so, and I've, you know, I've made a living out of it for the last 15 years, so I guess... And the farm doesn't make us any... The farm gives us a quality of life rather than... You know, it's just one... It's like a boat, really. It's a hole into which we pour money. But it gives us a wonderful quality of life living here. And I farm. I'm not a very good farmer. I'm a bit of a crap farmer, really. I love farming passionately, but I'm not very good at it. Writing, yep, I love writing too. So, yeah, I'm a writer, I guess.
Could you have stayed on the farm without the books?
Well, it's a good question. I think we would have done. I know we would have done, because I can't see any alternative. We burned our boats and spent everything on the farm. I guess we'd have found other ways of making a living, and we'd have survived. But it would have been harder, much harder than it is. It's made, you know, we still live in the same place, and we love living here, and our lifestyle hasn't changed an awful lot, but it's much more comfortable and much easier.
One of the great cultural contributions given by Spain to the world is the Carmen. Now, a true Carmen is an enclosed patio garden on the hill of the Albaicín in Granada, and to qualify for the name, it must have a view of the Alhambra and the peaks of the Sierra Nevada beyond. Apart from that, a number of essential elements can be deployed more or less at random. These include grapevines, tall, slender cypresses, orange and lemon trees, a persimmon or two, perhaps a pomegranate, and myrtle, whose scent was believed by the Moors to embody the very essence of love. The surface of a Carmen should be cobbled in the style known as El Empedrado Granadino, a grey and white pattern, again devised by the Moors, using the river stones that occur in abundance throughout the province. There should also be a fountain and a pool, and preferably a number of runnels and rills leading the water hither and thither in a fashion perfectly conceived to make you feel cool and contemplative on a hot summer's day. If the thing has been done right, the interplay between light and shade, the mingling scents of the flowers, and the chuckling of the water in its channels will induce a profound contentment and sense of peace as you wander the cobbled paths, perhaps hand in hand with a good friend, musing playfully, the pair of you, upon the mysteries of the universe. If you're really fortunate, a nightingale will come and nest in your cypress tree, and then the pleasure becomes sublime. But that can't be counted on, so most Carmen owners make do with a canary in a cage. I personally rather like the sound of a caged canary. It's one of the essentials of a Spanish street, but it hardly compares to the nightingales. And besides, the song of the caged bird should be more a source of distress than pleasure to sensitive modern man. Thank you.
That was author Chris Stewart reading from his book. The third in the series, that was the Almond Blossom Appreciation Society. The first three books are available from RNIB Talking Books, and all of Chris's books are available wherever books are sold.
Now it's back to Sally Vickers for the books of her life. Sally, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I read an enormous amount. I read young, and I was lucky in having a wonderful children's librarian who I celebrate in my novel, The Librarian. The book that she introduced me to that has been most significant was Tom's Midnight Garden by Philippa Pierce. She introduced me to Philippa Pierce through The Minnow on the Say. I loved that book so much, I bought Tom's Midnight Garden on my 10th birthday with a book token from one of the children's bookshops that then existed. And that book is magical. It's about a garden, which is very significant. It has also got a very interesting account of the way time is not linear. And that, too, is something that I have tended to pursue in my own books. So I think it was probably incredibly important. Another very important book was At the Back of the North Wind by George MacDonald, who's not as well known now as he should be, better known for The Princess and Curdie and The Princess and the Goblin. But At the Back of the North Wind is a very strange and remarkable book. And that too was introduced to me by my children's librarian, Miss Blackhall. So I would say those two books have been most influential on my writing as well as my reading.
Not unless you put the clock back, Uncle Alan said carelessly in answer to Tom's last question. Tom doodled with his pen in the corner of the letter he was writing to Peter, a clock dial, which he then enclosed at the top of a tall rectangular case, a grandfather clock, in fact. He took some minutes to complete it. Then he addressed his uncle again. What clock?
What did you say, Tom?
You said a tree could not be lying fallen at one time and then be standing up again as it was before it fell, unless you put the clock back. What clock?
Oh, no particular clock.
Tom scribbled out his sketch of the grandfather clock.
It's just a saying. To put the clock back, Tom. It means to have the past again, and no one can have that. Time isn't like that.
His uncle returned to his reading, and Tom began doodling in another part of the writing paper.
Elizabeth Proud narrating Tom's Midnight Garden by Philippa Pierce, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, there are several read, but I think the one I would choose is Lolly Willows by Sylvia Townsend Warner. I met Sylvia Townsend Warner when she was writing a book about T.H. White, who taught my father English when he was a boy. So she came to interview him. I had already read Lolly Willows. My wonderful godmother, who was much the inspiration behind The Gardener, in fact, gave it to me. And I fell in love with it. As many of your listeners will know, it's a story about a woman who becomes a witch. I told Sylvia Townsend Warner that I had ambitions to become a witch, and she looked at me rather slyly and said she thought I had many of the potential attributes, which I took as a great compliment. So it's remained for me a favourite, and I'm delighted that her writing has become popular again with the young. She fell out of fashion. She's very much back in fashion, and I do make a sly reference to Lolly Willows in The Gardener, because there is an element of the supernatural in the book.
When her father died, Laura Willows went to live in London with her elder brother and his family. Of course, said Caroline, you will come to us. But it will upset all your plans. It will give you so much trouble. Are you sure you really want me? Oh, dear, yes. Caroline spoke affectionately, but her thoughts were elsewhere. They had already journeyed back to London to buy an eiderdown for the bed in the small spare room. If the washstand were moved towards the door, would it be possible to fit in a writing table between it and the fireplace? Perhaps a bureau would be better because of the extra drawers. Yes, that was it. Lolly could bring the little walnut bureau with the false handles on one side and the top that jumped up when you touched the spring by the inkwell.
Gretel Davis narrating Lolly Willows by Sylvia Townsend Warner, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, I have been rereading recently Elizabeth Taylor, who is another writer who is not sufficiently well known. And I've read pretty much all her work, reread pretty much all her work recently. I would suggest The Wedding Group is one that your readers might enjoy. I don't know if Elizabeth Taylor, not to be confused with the actress, is on audiobooks, but if not, she should be. And if she isn't, I'm going to try and read them, if they'll let me.
The Quain ladies, adjusting their mantillas, hurried across the courtyard to the chapel. The three daughters of Harry Breton, painter and pronouncer, had plain names which were impossible to shorten: Rose, Jane, and Kate. At the time of the mass conversion, the whole family at once, to Roman Catholicism, other Christian names had been added, but were not used. The granddaughters, two of whom followed them across the courtyard, had somehow lost their first names. Imogen, Cressida, and Petronella were now Mo and Cressy and Pet. Quain was mostly a world of women.
Elizabeth Proud, once again, narrating The Wedding Group by Elizabeth Taylor, which you can also find in the RNIB Library.
Sally Vickers, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
It's been a huge pleasure. It's been really, really good to talk to you, and I'm so happy that you've responded to the book in the way that I really like my readers to respond. So thank you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.